Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Thanks for being with us. Well, I'm sorry to say that we were not able to hook up with Nicholson Baker, the scheduled first hour guest this morning. We were going to be talking about his recent book, Human Smoke, The Beginnings of World War II, The End of Civilization. It's been getting a lot of press, provoking some rather extreme reaction, both positive and negative. I think he has some very interesting things to say. So we will see if we can get with him and get that program rescheduled, and we'll do that on another day, and of course we'll let you know when it's coming up. Instead, what we'll do here in hour number one is go to the archives of Focus for a program from last year. This was a conversation with Ken Osgood, who teaches at Florida Atlantic University. We talked about his book Total Cold War, Eisenhower's Battle at Home and Abroad. This program first broadcast on December 19th, so as you listen during this first hour, do keep in mind that we'll not be taking calls. In this hour of the program, we'll be looking back to the Cold War and to the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. When Eisenhower spoke at this time of waging total Cold War, what he was talking about was a global battle for hearts and minds. Virtually every country in the free world was targeted, including our own. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with historian Kenneth Osgood about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, Total Cold War. The subtitle is Eisenhower's Secret Propaganda Battle at Home and Abroad. The book is published by the University Press of Kansas. And among other things, it shows how major campaigns of the time, things like Atoms for Peace and People to People, blurred the lines between foreign and domestic propaganda as they targeted both the American people and also used them in a global contest for public opinion. Our guest, Kenneth Osgood, is assistant professor of history at Florida Atlantic University, and I'm sure that you can find the book if you're interested in taking a look. Professor Osgood, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Is this David?
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yes. Yes. Just as a matter of curiosity, I'm interested in how it is that for you the area of Cold War propaganda became something that was your specialty.
Well, it was really kind of an accident in some ways. I started researching in graduate school on the origins of the space race. And as I started looking at the declassified documents, I was really intrigued by how often American officials talked about the space race in terms of its psychological impact, and that was the kind of phrase they used. And every little tiny initiative and every sort of angle of the early program, and this is even before Sputnik, was talked about in terms of its impact on foreign public opinion and on the morale and resolve of the American public. So I became really fascinated by that and just started digging around in the archives for other examples of concern for this psychological impact that American leaders talked about in the 1950s. And I kept finding more and more of it. And as I kept digging, the connections between such talk and sort of explicit propaganda campaigns became really striking to me, and that's how I got into this.
Yeah. One of the things that strikes me and I think is interesting is that, you know, when I think about the Cold War, I guess I think of the a pervasive, generalized kind of anxiety about the fact that the Cold War could go hot, and the fact that always in the background, somewhere always in the back of people's minds, was this idea that the United States and the Soviet Union had this power to essentially destroy the world a couple of times over, and that there was that thing that, you know, maybe it wasn't the first thing on your mind, but it was somehow always there. And I was really struck by the fact that what you note is that at the time, if people you engage them in conversation about Cold War, they might not really have been able to give you a very good definition of what it was, but they were very conscious of the fact that essentially the way the Cold War was waged was with words, and that what we're really talking about here is, as you write about it in the book, a war of words, a war of ideas, and a war of propaganda. People apparently were very quite aware of that fact even then, here in the 1950s.
Yeah, I shared a similar sort of set of experiences that you described. And in fact, one of my earliest memories as a child, if not the earliest, but it's one of the most striking of my memories growing up in the 70s, was driving on the family vacation in the back of a big brown station wagon and asking my dad as a young child what the difference was between an A-bomb and an H-bomb. And as I look back on that, it sort of reminds me how even for young children, some kind of knowledge of the destructiveness that the Cold War could be was lurking in my mind. And so, the second answer to your first question also about how I got into this was in looking through the records and the archives. Like yourself, I was completely blown away by the fact, no pun intended, I guess, by the fact that American officials often said with a surprising amount of certainty that the Soviet Union does not want war, it's not likely to start a war, it recognizes it's in a position of weakness, and that the military component, as important as it is not really where the major Cold War lies, that the most important and salient feature of the Cold War lay in the psychological arena in the realm of ideology and public opinion.
Let me ask you also to talk a little bit about the term total war and what exactly that, at least at this time, when people used that phrase, what it was they meant.
Yeah, the term total war kind of grew out of the global experience, actually, with the First World War, as people came to terms with the fact that that war was really appeared to be unlike any other. It was served by just unprecedentedly large armies. It was very mechanized and really relied on not so much the skill and valor of the individual soldier as on the industrial machinery that each side could bring to bear in combat. And so when they first started using the term total war, it referred to this sort of concept that the home front was as important to the war effort as the front line or as the troops. And it came to be used even more consciously in the Second World War in this kind of framework, the notion that the Rosie the Riveters who went to the factories were doing, you know, as important a job to waging the war as the boys out on the front line. Mm-hmm. And so this was sort of this idea that the home front was intimately connected with the war effort. And in fact, the success or failure in large measure depended on the home front. And when the Second World War ended and the Cold War started, this sort of generation of Americans, particularly those in leadership positions who had lived through two world wars that were considered to be total war, sort of took this concept of total war and applied it to the Cold War and came to argue that the Cold War was also a total war, but it was a different kind of war. It's not one where shots are going to be fired, most likely, but it's a war that's going to be fought on the realm of ideas and on symbols and on ideology. Mm-hmm. And so what the implication of that was that people at home, how they acted, what they did, what kinds of things happened in the United States mattered as much as the kinds of things the American government did abroad, that we would win the ideological contest on the strength of our economy, on the strength of our ideas, and on the strength with which we sort of lived up to our ideas or projected a positive image abroad.
Yeah. And I think, again, as a general point, I think what's really striking about this this time and this effort is that it was not just outer-directed. And not just the effort wasn't just to persuade people who might already be our friends or might not that of the rightness of the United States and its foreign policy and its economic policy and its position of leadership in the world and so forth, not just to persuade others of the rightness of all of that, but that part of the deal here was an effort by the government of the United States to persuade Americans of the rightness of all of that.
Absolutely, and that also ties into this notion of total war, because one of the corollaries of the idea of warfare being total and the home front mattering so much, the assumption that many leaders, those in leadership positions, came to believe was that the public needed to be mobilized to support total war. And this, during the First and Second World Wars in the United States, this took the form of very concerted, large-scale domestic propaganda campaigns orchestrated by government agencies, official government agencies, as well as private groups that were working with the government. And when the Cold War came about, this same sort of ideology, the same set of opinions, led American leaders to say, we also need to maintain the morale of the American public. But in fact, they came to believe that it was in some ways more important during the Cold War because of the fact there had been no Pearl Harbor, there were no boys dying, in terms of direct conflict with the Soviet Union per se. Because the Cold War was cold, there was a concern that people would stop caring about it, that it wouldn't be real to them, that they would be easily intimidated by Soviet nuclear progress as the Soviet built up its nuclear arsenal in particular. And so there's a sense that we really need to pay as much attention, if not more attention, to the morale and attitudes of our own people as we do to those of our friends and our enemies. Mm.
Just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have just tuned in, Kenneth Osgood. He is assistant professor of history at Florida Atlantic University. As an historian, has made a particular area specialty in the propaganda efforts of the Cold War era, and is the author of this book, Total Cold War. The subtitle is Eisenhower's Secret Propaganda Battle at Home and Abroad, and it's published by the Kansas University Press of Kansas. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure at this time that we're talking about here, starting in the mid-1950s, the idea that mass media could be mobilized to effectively put out a particular kind of message, and that message could either be commercial, in a sense, or it could be political. That, by 1955, that certainly was a new notion that at least goes back to the time of World War One. But was there something going on here at the time that that was a sort of a new wrinkle on this, or some kind of greater understanding about how this process can be made to work?
Well, I think if there's a critical difference in terms of how particularly government groups, government leaders perceived the goal of mobilizing people's minds, if there's a critical difference between the early Cold War period and that of, say, the First World War or the Second World War, it was an understanding that the government would be most persuasive and most effective if it concealed its role and if it acted in ways that would not draw attention to itself or would not provoke a domestic backlash. And both Presidents Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, when they had created these big sprawling domestic propaganda operations in the First and Second World Wars, had been the targets of extraordinary partisan attacks. The idea of a domestic propaganda agency under the service of a particular president really raised a lot of concerns in Congress, particularly among the opposition parties. And so these agencies were big headaches for the presidents, and they raised legitimate concerns about what kind of government we want, and they also raised uncomfortable parallels with totalitarian regimes. Those are the kind of people who use propaganda agencies, not an American democracy. So the key change, I think, in the early Cold War period was the notion that whatever we're going to do to mobilize the American public, we have to do it in a way that is different from how it had been done in those earlier conflicts. And it needs to be a way that works through existing media, that works through private groups, that uses networks that government officials had within the private sphere to get their message across, rather than, say, these really kind of heavy-handed, hard-selling appeals that were more common during those earlier conflicts.
Mm. Why don't we go ahead and bring in a caller here? We have somebody who'd like to join us and share some of their thoughts and questions. And, of course, anybody who's listening can do that, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller, I believe, is in Effingham, and this is line 4. Hello.
Yes, this subject matter is so vast, and I could take up the whole hour commenting, but I concentrate on one area. 1948, when Harry Truman was elected, began to expand the hot war towards Korea. Then, on the heels of that, came Joe McCarthy, who proceeded to annihilate any sort of left ideas in the movie industry, and all that has now progressed into every media that is extant today, and which is no surprise, because in my opinion, the state, which is a tool of the establishment, which is the bourgeoisie, then all the diktats come from the establishment rather from the state. The state only carries it out, and people like Joe McCarthy and others to this day, you have the Rush Limbaugh and all that sort of thing, it is so predictable that it borders on humor. You know, there's no humor in it. I mean, it's a deadly process. But that's my contribution, and I'll ring off and listen. And thank you very much.
All right. Well, you can comment on it any way you like.
Sure. Well, thanks for the comments. The caller's first initial remark about how the subject being so vast calls to mind an experience I've had repeatedly in working on this project when I'd meet people and they'd ask me, what are you writing about? And I'd say, I'm writing about Cold War propaganda. Almost without exception, I got the same response, particularly from older persons who had lived through the era. There's a lot of that has been a common thread and a perception that indeed the Cold War was overridden with propaganda concerns. I might qualify some of the caller statements that sort of paint this picture of a big monolithic state working closely with the establishment, McCarthy and Truman kind of working in concert for the same thing. There are key differences, of course, between the many actors that make up the American government. And, you know, McCarthy and Truman are great examples. They were both hated each other. And they may have had similar views about the Cold War, but they also had key differences about the nature of the conflict. And McCarthy was using his own anti-communist propaganda to further his own ends, probably more so than he was that of the state. And in fact, if you talk to any of former officials who had served in the U.S. Information Agency, which was the official government propaganda arm throughout the Cold War, if you talk to them, most of them will have jarring, personally painful memories of the period when Joe McCarthy was active, in part because he turned his attention to the U.S. Information Agency and began making allegations that it was filled with communists. And so here you have these guys who are overseas trying to sell the American way of life, and a senator is investigating them for alleged communist sympathies. And you have these really embarrassing moments in 1952 and 1953 when some of McCarthy's aides are traveling around Europe burning American books by suspected leftists. And you can't imagine anything that more damaged America's reputation in Europe than these kinds of activities. So anything that the USIA was doing to try to make the United States look good was immediately kind of thrown out the window by this sort of rabid anti-communism that you saw represented by McCarthy and others.
All right. Well, again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I think one of the things that you are wanting to do also in this book is, in addition to talking about the effort that the government was involved in, to document, in a sense, how personally Dwight Eisenhower was involved in this, which tends to, I think, run counter to the kind of picture of him as president that a lot of people have. And I know that this is something I think historians in recent years, maybe not so recent, but certainly in recent years, have been trying to change this view of Eisenhower and to give people an appreciation that perhaps he was a better president and a more engaged president than a lot of people think. You, in fact, here mentioned the fact that when he was running for the presidency in the fall of 1952, he gave a speech and he was talking about American foreign policy, and he said right out that psychological warfare had to be an important feature of it. And he says that, you know, he just says to people, don't be afraid of this. What we're really talking about here is the struggle for the minds and wills of men. And he went on, after he was elected president, to be himself quite personally involved in creating and implementing psychological warfare strategies that were aimed at making this message, the message we wanted to get across, more effective. Can you talk about how it is and why it is that Dwight Eisenhower so personally involved himself in this process?
Yeah, I think it was one of the things that really shocked me when I started doing this research. I didn't really set out to write a book about Eisenhower, and I didn't think he would play a very large role in the project. If you think about the kinds of propaganda activities we know about, they're usually run by bureaucracies. I mean, the CIA was involved in some kinds of activities, the U.S. Information Agency, during the First World War and the Second World War, there were specific entities that were created for the purpose of propaganda. So I didn't really expect the president to have sort of a hands-on approach or a particularly significant role. But when I started researching in the declassified documents, I was completely amazed by how often and how enthusiastically Eisenhower injected himself into the propaganda war. And he really had this vision of himself that came out of his experience in the Second World War and immediately afterwards when he was head of NATO and he was trying to create the North Atlantic Alliance. He had this notion that America, the United States, was leading a global coalition. It was leading an international coalition. And one of its major tasks was to enhance the cohesion of that coalition. And so he had this sort of sense of himself as leading not just the country, but also the international community. And he carried this kind of perspective with him to the White House. And he really believed that one of his key goals as president was to lead this international coalition, to make sure it was coherent, and to work on the morale, was a kind of term he used a lot, the morale of the country, of other countries that were working closely with the United States. So part of it evolved from his experience in the war when he was one of the few commanders who really took psychological warfare seriously. And if you sort of picture the Army culture, most of the during the war, the major battles are won and lost, of course, by bullets being fired and land being taken. And many, hardcore soldiers looked at, leaflets and radio broadcasts as kind of fluffy hocus-pocus that was not to be taken too seriously. And Eisenhower understood it to be really, really important. In the military theaters he commanded, something like 2 billion leaflets were dropped, which would add up for enough for every man, woman, and child on Earth to have about 4 leaflets. So he took it seriously, integrated into his military campaigns, and then he brought it with him to the presidency. And even as president, he had a really sophisticated notion of what propaganda should be. He didn't believe it should be sort of heavy-handed, the voice of the state. He believed it should be subtle, it should be covert. He also believed it should be positive. If you look at the kinds of things the Truman administration did, the activities largely resembled those of Joseph Goebbels and the Nazis. I mean, it's really sort of dramatic pictures of bloodthirsty communists and, really dramatic and exaggerated kind of claims. And Eisenhower said that stuff doesn't work. We need to project a more positive image. We need to try to reduce the visibility of the American government in these things, and we need to try to be more persuasive. And those kind of ideas shaped his approach to psychological warfare. Mm.
And this did happen in both overt and covert ways.
Absolutely, yeah. If anything, what you see if a major change under the Eisenhower administration is more and more stuff is going into the covert field. And what you have is sort of this bifurcated operation. You have, on the one hand, these sort of obvious kinds, of what they call white propaganda, which is official propaganda that's acknowledged by the government. Things like the Voice of America or the USIA maintained these reading rooms and libraries overseas. Anybody who encountered those knew they were American government products. But Eisenhower said, we need to do less of that and more of the covert stuff. And so as a result, not just the CIA, but also the U.S. Information Agency is doing the majority of its efforts to influence public opinion abroad secretly. And that involves subsidies to newspapers. Sometimes it's just giving them free content. Here's a press release or here's a story for you. Can you run it? Sometimes it's manipulation. Sometimes it's working through front organizations. A whole range of things that were effectively designed to keep the American label out of the propaganda business and instead to work through existing media outlets or things that look indigenous.
Let's take another caller here in Champaign County on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
I had three things, and then I'll just sort of maybe expect the implicit follow-ups to be asked because I'm going forward. But there's a persistent kind of theme of the idea that the war, Cold War, was kind of a ruse that was, in particularly in the Third World, people would think that, well, of course we're being contested over, but they're basically contesting over who gets to exploit. So it's sort of a, this is kind of vulgar, but I guess for the idea of total war, they would think, well, we are fighting for the resources, and that's fundamental to what's going on. The other thing I wanted you to address was the kitchen debate, the idea that, you know, the leaders of, some leaders of these two countries were actually arguing about who had the better appliances. And and then more generally, and I'll ring off, is the work of Herb Schiller, who used to be at the University of Illinois, Mass Communication, the American Empire, Mind Managers, a whole series of things that he did about propaganda and generated, some of the students generated a lot, too. So as the ambience is going loud here, I'll hang up and listen on the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the call and the comments. I don't know too much about Herb Schiller other than his Mind Managers work and some which coincided with a greater awareness going on in the country about the power of propaganda and public relations and advertising, a greater sort of sensitivity to it. And in part, it's that greater sensitivity to propaganda is what's leading Eisenhower and others to move propaganda more into the covert field. They recognize that people are more savvy about these things, they're more informed about these things than they were in the past, and therefore it's more important to do things on the down low, as it were. In terms of the Third World, I think your caller is right to a great extent when he talks about the Cold War and the Third World as being a fight for resources. And if you sort of do just a simple perusing of any once classified document, and they're not too difficult to find from the 1950s and indeed through much of the Cold War, you'll find that they're framing the contest of the Cold War very much in terms of resources, even though there are also politics and ideas tying in there. And Eisenhower was quite explicit about his concern over key resources in the Third World. For example, this famous speech he gave related to Vietnam when the French were still fighting the conflict, and a press conference, and a reporter asks him why should we be involved in Vietnam, and Eisenhower compares it to a row of dominoes. And this famous domino analogy, which had played such a big role in escalating the war in Vietnam and justifying the war in Vietnam, if you look at that comment more closely, you'll find that what he also talks about is the key resources of these areas will fall under communist domination. And once you start looking for it, you'll find that references to the importance of resources in various areas, whether the Middle East or Africa or Southeast Asia, are often tied in terms of resources. So it's not incidental, as your caller perceived. As for the kitchen debate, it was indeed a sort of bizarre moment. It was when 1959, Richard Nixon goes to Moscow, meets with Nikita Khrushchev. Nixon at the time was the vice president for President Eisenhower, and travels, sees some Moscow, and then they have at this World's Fair. They stand in this kitchen and kind of debate the quality of the appliances, as the caller pointed out. The interesting thing about that, from my perspective, is that Americans largely concluded that Nixon won that debate. He really held his own. But when I looked at the videotape of the time, I saw something different. I saw Nixon looked antagonistic, defensive. I guess that's kind of how Nixon looked, but kind of crotchety. And Khrushchev was lively, funny. You know, he was a little bullish, but he had this really kind of humorous kind of quality to him. And he was smiling and all these things. And in some ways, that was a big victory for Khrushchev, because here he was with the great American, you know, antagonist, and he's talking to him friendly, in a friendly way, on Soviet soil about, you know, living conditions for the people. And this was important for the Soviets in particular, or at least for Khrushchev's strategy, because Stalin had sort of the opposite approach. He was gruff. He had alienated much of the international community. He had, as much as anyone, he was responsible for isolating the Soviet Union by sort of gruff, clumsy diplomacy. Whether he wanted a Cold War or not is a matter of some debate, but certainly his tactics were so crude that he isolated a good chunk of the world. And Khrushchev, when he came in, and his earlier predecessor, really perceived this vulnerability and said, we want to end Soviet isolation, and tried to project a more friendly, peaceful image. And that actually worked to a certain extent. It helped free communism from the stigma of Stalinism, and it conveyed this message that a communist country can be something other than a Stalinist country. And Khrushchev, I think, really helped his country politically by adopting this more friendly tone. And Americans, for their part, perceived it as a huge threat. And in fact, I think one of the really remarkable things about, if you look at the documents in this period, is the fact that here is the new Soviet leaders, Khrushchev and his early predecessors, talking about peaceful coexistence, talking about finding ways to solve some of the superpower problems. They're saying really positive things from the standpoint of international cooperation, easing the arms race, etc. And Americans in the intelligence community and in the Eisenhower administration were describing this new peaceful approach of Soviet foreign policy as a greater threat to world peace than Stalinism. It's absolutely remarkable to sort of see that frame, that this is more dangerous to us than Stalin, of all people.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, here in this exhibition that you were talking about, that featured this model house with the kitchen where Nixon and Khrushchev had the debate over appliances, that obviously the United States here was trying to promote the idea that its economic system, capitalism, could deliver this very high standard of living. And what they were, the idea was that they were trying to sell to the Russians and anybody else, was that this is the way all Americans lived, and it was capitalism that could make that possible. And going back to, I'm thinking about the caller's comment about people in the developing world saw the superpower battle as being a battle over who the United States or the Soviet Union got to exploit them. I wondered, you know, to the extent to which at this time propaganda effort of the United States really was directed to promoting an image that says, no, not only is the United States not interested in exploiting you, but what the United States is really interested in sharing the many wonderful benefits of the American way of life with you, and that's really what it is that the United States is interested in. It's just sharing good things with other people.
Absolutely. I mean, you couldn't have described it better, that this was the core message that the United States wanted to convey to the world, that we're interested not in exploiting you, but in providing you the good things that come from our way of life, from capitalism, from free elections, from democracy, and all these things. The interesting thing, when you think about that the kitchen debate and the debate over appliances, as we're calling it, is that it was highlighting, of course, the consumer benefits of American capitalism. But there was a lot of concern that people abroad thought that Americans were too fixated on gadgets and gizmos and too consumeristic. And one of the, if you want to sort of list what they called propaganda problems that the United States faced, near the top of the list was this perception that was widely held in Europe and the Third World and elsewhere, was that the Americans were just sort of this materialistic culture. And the Americans had a really hard time sort of resolving this tension between the fact that they wanted to promote the high standard of living they enjoyed, the comforts and benefits that came from capitalism as they saw it, but they also wanted to suggest that Americans had deeper values, that they had spiritual values, that they had cultural values. And you find all these tensions in the kinds of messages they're doing. On the one hand, they're advertising toasters and distributing Sears catalogs in the Third World. But on the other hand, they're trying to say, hey, we have deeper values than that. And they really weren't able well to resolve that kind of tension in their own message.
We're just a bit past, maybe more than a bit past the midpoint here, and I should introduce again our guest, Kenneth Osgood. He is assistant professor of history at Florida Atlantic University and has done a lot of writing about propaganda in the Cold War era, and that is certainly very much an important theme of this book that we mentioned. The title is Total Cold War, Eisenhower's Secret Propaganda Battle at Home and Abroad. It's published by the University Press of Kansas. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to make sure that we spend some time talking about some specific programs, because a lot of the book is devoted to looking at these programs, what it was they were intended to do. Things like, for example, Atoms for Peace. And we talked a little bit earlier about the fact, I talked about how, certainly when I think back about this time, the time of the Cold War, I think of the concerns that people had about the existence of nuclear weapons and their destructive power. This was a program that, at least on the face of it, was trying to persuade people that atomic energy could be used in a peaceful and beneficial way, and that in fact that was something that the United States was interested in trying to promote generally. What was Atoms for Peace all about?
Well, Atoms for Peace was an initiative that Eisenhower promoted at the end of 1953, at the end of his first year as president, and it quickly developed into the largest single propaganda campaign of his administration. And in some ways, it was probably the largest single propaganda campaign in American history, although I haven't done the comparative work of it. But it was a very, very concerted campaign to promote the idea of the peaceful atom. And here's kind of how it played out. Eisenhower was interested in making a new disarmament initiative that would win him public accolades in the court of world opinion. And his advisors, he was also interested at the same time of dealing with the fact that the United States and previously the Soviet Union had developed a hydrogen bomb, which was infinitely more powerful than the atomic bomb and capable of a new level of horror and destruction that most Americans did not understand and were not well informed about. So he's toying with these two ideas, these two problems, and comes up with this idea for Atoms for Peace. And the basic proposal was presented as a disarmament proposal. He said the United States and the Soviet Union, he spoke before the United Nations in December 1953, and proposed that the United States and the Soviet Union would take fissionable materials from the nuclear weapons stockpiles, turn them over to an international agency, and put them forward to peaceful uses like atomic power production, treatment of cancer, other medical uses, use in agriculture, and other things. And he said that this would be a first step towards Cold War cooperation and a first step toward disarmament and a first step toward peace. And it was very well received. It won him a lot of praise at home and a lot of praise abroad for it being sort of an imaginative approach to arms control. But what it really amounted to was a PR for the atom. And if you look at what he and other his advisors were trying to do, they were really concerned that people at home and abroad, when they heard the word atom, they immediately thought of the word bomb, and it raised people's fear level. And as Eisenhower is looking on greatly expanding the U.S. nuclear arsenal in the next several years as part of his national security strategy, he's worried that he would be kept from doing so by fear of the atom, that allies would be too afraid, or that the American public would be too worried about atomic destruction, and that they would turn against his policy of a nuclear buildup. And so this was part of a PR campaign to say, hey, the atom's not so bad, and it brings us lots of wonderful things, too. And as part of this, you had all this sort of media blitz that went on for 8 years about all the wonderful things atoms could do. And this included, you know, for example, a National Geographic ran a cover story entitled Man's New Servant, the Friendly Atom. And inside the article talked about how atomic energy was making a better, more peaceful world. It's not about the bomb anymore. It's all about the hope of the future. And it highlighted some strange benefits of atomic research, such as a golf ball having been made radioactive so it could be located if it was lost. It had a picture of a young boy looking at a dog who was undergoing treatment for a cancerous tumor. And the headlines underneath, the caption underneath the photo said, "Even a dog's life can be made happier through atomic energy's healing power." And it echoed almost word for word the kinds of propaganda leaflets the Eisenhower administration was distributing abroad. And it was suggesting this better, brighter world that's going to come from the atom, not the horror of destruction. And it was very explicit in how they kind of promoted this really positive theme about the atom.
And in fact, also at the time, people, in addition to talking about peaceful uses of atomic energy, there people suggested all kinds of what now seems to be incredibly goofy things, quote-unquote, peaceful uses of atomic energy. Weapons that were supposed to make people feel sort of better about the fact that, well, yes, of course, we can blow up the world, but think of all these good things we could do with them. And it just now it seems kind of laughable. You wonder, did people actually buy any of this?
Yeah, there were some incredible proposals. The Atomic Energy Commission explored with all seriousness the prospect of creating a new harbor in Alaska by detonating a hydrogen bomb, you know, off the coast. And there were the CIA had proposed a plan for foiling a typhoon by firing an atomic weapon into it, and there are all kinds of really goofy, as a charitable word, proposals for using the bomb in ways that would seem helpful to mankind. And what's remarkable about them, one of the things that's remarkable about them, I should say, is that They were pursued in large measure for their public relations impact. It was understood that, yeah, they might have a tangible benefit, but their real thinking behind them rested around, this is something that could help us, help people feel more comfortable about the presence of nuclear weapons in the world.
So no one actually thought seriously that those things would be done. It was simply a matter of getting people to think in a more positive or maybe less negative way about them.
No, it was both at the same time. Oh. I think the atomic, certainly the, I don't know that the typhoon concept was pursued with any seriousness. I can't imagine what the guy was who came up with that one. But the, certainly the harbor off the coast of Alaska concept was pursued with great seriousness, and there were talks about, you know, using them to level mountains or using small nuclear weapons to blow out tunnels for trains or cars. Or, I mean, there's all kinds of uses that were discussed for nuclear explosions, and they were discussed with all seriousness as being both practical proposals that would be implemented and useful PR for the atom.
Let us, while we still have some time here, let's take another caller. We have someone in Urbana to talk with, line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you reached the secret subsidies of front organizations such as the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the many anti-communist publications that they supported, and the subsidies of publishers such as Prager and so on that published a lot of horrors of communism material. Or was this a later development? I'll hang up. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those were things I touch on in the book. They've been explored at length by some other scholars, so it doesn't receive a huge chunk of attention in my work. But the CIA began funding the Congress for Cultural Freedom in the early, I think, late 40s. In early 50s, and it was ostensibly an independent group that of intellectuals that were, you know, working to sort of have a liberal idea of the world that was not communist. And so they're sort of non-communist left. Many later claimed to not have known that the CIA was involved, and some have raised questions about, well, did they really know or not? But the CIA was only one sort of aspect of this kind of front organization. Also, the USIA was closely involved in activities that looked like covert operations. I should say the U.S. Information Agency, which was this not supposed to be a covert operation. It was covert agency. It was supposed to be a public information distribution kind of operation. And the caller mentioned Prager Press. And Prager, for example, received close subsidies from the U.S. Information Agency for its work. The Information Agency also subsidized a whole range of other books. Some were manuscripts that it commissioned itself. Others were books that they simply helped publish and distribute abroad inexpensively. developed all these kind of programs to try to disseminate American books abroad. And some of them would be anti-communist, and a lot of them would be great works of American literature or political histories that, you know, cast the United States in a favorable light. And the USIA would make them, help them get published and help them get distributed inexpensively abroad in really large quantities.
Just now, we're coming down to the point we have 3-4 minutes left. There's one other, at least, effort here that I'd like to give you a chance to talk about, and that is the efforts promoted by the United States to create opportunities for people-to-people contact. You know, the idea being that, at least ostensibly the idea being that, that people in other countries would have the opportunity to meet Americans, particularly young people, students, and that based on that experience, that means they would have a real experience with someone who was an American, would see that Americans are good people, and that overall that would be good for promoting the image of the United States. How well did this program, this kind of effort, work?
Well, the idea behind the people-to-people program, and it was largely Eisenhower and some of his close advisors' brainchild, was that we could reach more people abroad if we could sort of capitalize on private resources at home, if we get ordinary Americans to engage in public relations work on behalf of the government, whether that's businesses, doing advertising campaigns that said positive things about the United States, or whether it's pen pals, a whole kind of range of activities. But when they developed these plans, they had in mind two audiences. One, of course, was the international audience that they wanted to reach. But they also had a clear sense that people-to-people would help mobilize Americans. It would give them a sense of personal involvement in the Cold War. It would make them feel like they had a stake in the conflict because they had done something for it. And so people-to-people was as much about domestic mobilization as it was about international persuasion. In some ways, it was like the war bond campaigns, which are kind of the famous propaganda campaigns from the First and Second World War, with a big bloodthirsty picture of the Hun, and it says, buy war bonds, you know, to help the soldiers overseas and things like this. Those campaigns ostensibly were about selling, you know, bonds, but really they were about selling the war. And in a similar kind of way, these people-to-people activities were ostensibly about creating a positive view of Americans, but had a greater emphasis on getting Americans to do something so that they felt like they had a stake in what was going on in the broader world.
Mm. One of the things that I think is true when it comes to campaigns that are intended to push people in a certain direction, whether the object is to get them to buy something or whether the object is to persuade them of the rightness of a course of action or of a particular point of view, it's sometimes difficult, maybe it's even impossible, to determine just whether these efforts are effective or not. And I certainly think it's true of advertising that it's not all that easy to demonstrate whether, if you mount a campaign and you're trying to sell people something, it's pretty difficult to, with some certainty, to come back afterwards and say whether it worked or not. And I know that that's not exactly your purpose. Judging the effectiveness is not exactly your purpose, but I'm interested in your thoughts about that and whether, in a larger sense, at least if you ask this question, did these efforts, did they do what the administration and the government of the United States hoped they would do? Were they, in fact, effective?
Yeah, that's a great question, and you're right to raise all kind of caveats that it's very difficult to assess these things, even under ideal conditions, and it's even harder when looking in the past when records are scanty and Gallup polls are pretty uneven, and there's just not that kind of data you would like to use to even try to begin to make those claims. I think probably they helped mobilize, in terms of the United States audience, I think they helped mobilize people who were probably prone to mobilization anyway, but there's also evidence that their effects were limited and could backfire or were constrained by events outside their control. And I think the atomic energy example is especially revealing, that as much as the administration was trying to sell this image of the peaceful atom, that events beyond their control really undermined that message. Just a few months after Eisenhower launches Atoms for Peace, for example, a Japanese fishing boat is accidentally sprayed with radioactive waste from an atomic test in the Pacific Ocean. And the world media then becomes treated with this story of these Japanese fishermen who contract radiation sickness, and a couple of them die, and they go through these hideous illnesses, all the while the U.S. government's trying to tell them that the atom is really their friend. And so that the story runs away for them, and they lose control of that message and that sort of reality of international communication, that oftentimes deeds, actions, policies, events matter much more than words. And I think if there's a lesson that I took away from doing this research, it's that words can only accomplish so much, that in the end deeds have a much greater impact. And I think that's a lesson we've learned in a tough way in Iraq, certainly, recently.
Well, I suppose the other thing that I find myself wondering is that, you know, if you, in a broad sort of sense, if you ask who bought the message, whether, in fact, we did a better job of selling the message to ourselves than we did to anybody outside of the United States.
Yeah, it's a tough call. I mean, because there are certainly many things that foreigners find attractive and did find attractive about the American system. I mean, it's easy to be really turned off by some of these things we see in the Cold War the Americans were doing that were illegal, undemocratic, distasteful, stupid, goofy, you know, run through the gamut. But at the same time, they kind of pale in comparison to the gulag system that the Soviets constructed, the terrible state of the Soviet economy. You know, the countervailing example was not very pretty, although, of course, Americans did not always live up to their ideals, and that's where they often ran into trouble.
Well, there we will finish. The book, if you'd like to read it, is Total Cold War, Eisenhower's Secret Propaganda Battle at Home and Abroad. It's published by the University of Press of Kansas by our guest, Kenneth Osgood. He is Assistant Professor of History at Florida Atlantic University. Professor Osgood, thank you very much.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. The show was first broadcast on December 19th. Many of our past shows are there. You can listen anytime you like. Just go to WILL.illinois.edu, and you can find out the information that you need, and the program's there whenever you want them. And also, we will reschedule the program that we were going to do. We were going to talk with Nicholson Baker about his new book, Human Smoke. We will have that rescheduled for another day, and we'll give you a heads up if we get closer. WILL programming made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2008 series presents Shakespeare as a Sky Watcher, joining astronomy with English literature by David Levy on Tuesday, March 25th, 7:30 p.m. at the Beckman Institute. More information available online, www.cas.uiuc.edu. In the next hour, we'll be taking questions on women's health. Dr. Suzanne Troopen will be with us. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets. Stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson in Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
At 10:59 with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The prices are up after a sell-off last week all across the board on the Chicago Board of Trade. Long liquidation and profit taking place in the corn pit last week, as well as in the beans. A strike in Argentina also playing on the bean prices. Taking a look at the current trade in Kansas City, the May wheat contract is up 38.5 cents a bushel at 10.70 and a half. July at 10.57, up 40. May wheat in Chicago is at 10.38 and a quarter, up now 10.38 and three quarters, up 51 and a quarter cents. July 10.32, up 45 and a half. July also 10.32, up 45 and a half. May corn is currently at 5.21 and a quarter, up 13 and three quarter cents. July 5.33, up 13 and three quarters. September corn 5.35 and a half, up 12 and a half. Dece corn 5.34 and a quarter.